Protecting the right to transact is critical for guaranteeing freedom of speech. And this week's conversation dives into how Bitcoin's unstoppable nature can protect and enshrine basic human rights and freedoms. We're joined by prominent Canadian Bitcoiner BJ Dichter. BJ played a pivotal role in the 2022 Ottawa Trucker Convoy protest and has since gone on to write the book Honking for Freedom, which is a detailed account of the events from that winter. I'm Scott Dietles, and I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. The events of the 2022 protest created for people watching all over the world a new reason to study and learn about Bitcoin. So if you're interested to learn something about one of the most significant political events in Canadian history and how Bitcoin's unstoppable nature influenced the outcome, stick around.
So I remember I was watching, I already was reading stuff about it, and they found a TED Talk on blockchain, and that might have been already while I was into it. But like Bitcoin was kind of the secondary thing. But, you know, we were discussing this in the Twitter space the other day. I think there's two eras of when people came into Bitcoin. There are people who've come in over the past few years, as we've seen encroaching authoritarianism, and people have gotten concerned and want some sort of insurance policy against that. And those are many of the people I was able to orange pill after the Freedom Convoy, for example. But when I was getting into it, it was more of a curiosity because I'm like a techie nerd. I had my first computer when I was 3 years old. It was a pet emulator with a cassette deck. We had pets and Commodores and Olivetti's and everything. So kind of grown up around computers. But when I was 17 years old, I had already passed the point in my life where I decided no more TV shows. If I'm going to turn on the television, I'm going to learn something. So it has to be documentaries or news or whatever it is. And I came across this documentary series by Bill Still called The Money Changers or The Money Masters. I think it had a different title in the US and Canada, whatever it was. An extensive documentary on the history of central banking and our banking system. And around that time, I had been rewatching James Burke's series on connections. And he had a short series of episodes on money and the history of money and what are tally sticks and what is a taller versus a dollar, stuff like that. So that was in my mid to late teens. So I was already primed for, oh, okay, our financial system's nonsense. Our money's all fake fugazis. It's coupons. Okay. And then when I came across this blockchain thing, whatever it was just a curiosity. It was just another thing in computers and tech that people were talking about. And I'm like, okay, I should learn what that is. And on that journey, the word Bitcoin came up in the conversation. I'm like, oh, what is this? And I'm like, oh, this solves the problem that I had learned many, many years ago as a kid. Cool, I get it. And why don't I just get a little bit of Bitcoin and start playing with it? There weren't too many wallets, but there were enough different wallets to just download a whole bunch of them. And I had discovered some guy on the internet who just started his YouTube channel called BTC Sessions, who was in Thailand and Calgary of weird mix and showing people how to use a Bitcoin ATM. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So it's just kind of like it was more of an interest in technology sort of thing. I didn't really think or realize that it would actually accelerate in value. Like now we say, oh, it's obvious. Everybody would have known that, but nobody did know that, or very few people knew that. And then all of a sudden it starts to shoot up. It's like, oh yeah, the scarcity thing. That's right. And so there you go. That's how I got into it.
BJ Dichter, welcome to the show. We'll see how the you discovered Bitcoin and you got involved in the late 2010s. And flash forward, and it's 2020, and I guess it's 2022. Sort of. There's been 2 years now of I would say the Canadian government doing stuff that we probably most of us like just never expected we would kind of like endure. And you would have been in this really unique position. When I think about Bitcoin, I think of the number of people who really understood it before 2020, I think was a pretty small number. Yeah. Particularly people who had been, you know, like studying it for more than a little while. So I'd love to hear your thoughts around, you know, thinking about what was going on during that time and simultaneously sort of understanding the potential for what uncensorable money might mean, you know, as you were going through like, those years.
It's funny, you know, I don't think I'm alone in at that time. People thought it's an insurance policy, but that's going to be for other places that have political strife, political instability, right? Whether it's, I don't know, you choose Iran, now we have Ukraine, a place around the world where there's political instability. You always think that it's going to be someplace. It's not going to happen here. So for me, yeah, I'm definitely more libertarian leaning. I'm not an anti-statist, but, you know, I'm not that far. But, you know, I'm close, very close to Milei, but not quite there. But, you know, I never really anticipated, no matter how bad things would get here with our government, I didn't think it would get that bad. And I think the reason is because I ran for parliament on the federal level. I got involved in politics just because I saw some of the lunacy within our political structure locally. And I just got fed up. I had a business in the neighborhood. I'm like, you know what? My local city councilor is a pain in the rear. I'm going to go out of my way. I'm going to get involved and make her life miserable. We'll see how things go. The next thing you know, I'm being tapped and asked to run federally. So I have maybe a little bit of a better understanding of how things work behind the scenes within the political structure. And I really did it just to everybody that is busy with kids and family. I was not. I was single. I was dating somebody. We didn't have a family at that point. I thought, well, if anybody's got the time to get involved and make a difference, this is my shot. Well, let's do this at least for a little bit. And I got to know a lot of people on the inside, how it all works, how the lobby class works, the people who fund the parties and fund the lobbies, and how they leverage one party against another, and how the media interacts with it, and how they're all completely incompetent, and everything is band-aided together and stuff like that. But as bad as that is, you just think, okay, it's kind of the Keystone Cops is how our government runs. But they're not going to be like authoritarian mullahs in Iran. Like, we're not going to have to deal with that. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. I never in a million years would have imagined that. So for me, yeah, the insurance off the system was interesting, but I really wasn't as concerned about that. I just thought it was cool tech. It kind of solved the problem of what I had learned about central banking many, many years before. And I like anything digital. I'm just a techno nerd. What can I tell you? But that whole episode completely changed and skewed my view and perspective. Now, I'm first and foremost, I don't care about the price. It could go down 50%. I don't care. As long as it's my money, nobody else can touch it. And I got to tell you, when you have your bank accounts and your credit cards and all your financial assets frozen or seized, however you want to describe it, without ever having been charged with any crime, that really wakes you up. And so I'm completely flipped, you know, what I see as the most important value of Bitcoin, where I was prior to where I am now because of that experience.
And for the benefit of our listeners who may be just catching up to the story, is it fair to say you were the lead? You're the lead fundraiser of the convoy protest in 2022. Is that the right way to describe it?
I mean, I always tell people I was the spokesperson and the media strategist. So all the messaging you saw coming out of it, that was kind of my domain. We started initially with a GoFundMe that Tamara had set up, and then she added me to it. So the two of us in conjunction were raising money around it, and all that money, most of it, which ended up being essentially returned by GoFundMe. The little bit that got through was confiscated and is now in escrow. And then Give, Send, Go was the second round of stuff. Same idea. Most of the money was returned. And then some, of that $3.5 million got released into the pipeline and got stopped by the government, the conservative government, by the way, went after Give, Send, Go. So this is not a partisan issue. And that money is all in escrow right now, about $6 million. But I was in my hotel room one night, and I think I'd just done every day and night I was doing interviews. And I did another interview with GB News or one of those, you know, media conglomerates overseas. Or maybe it might have been Newsmax. Anyways, I got a message from a guy named Caribou, who said, "Yeah, we're you're a Bitcoiner, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah," because what happened is, I guess they saw me in one of the interviews and they searched me on Twitter and saw hashtag Bitcoin. You know, it was always a subtle. No, I didn't talk to people about Bitcoin. I really didn't. I didn't know people in Bitcoin Twitter. I didn't hang out. I just, you know, watched Andreas Antonopoulos videos. The only Bitcoiner I met was James Altucher, who doesn't talk about Bitcoin anymore. But he was a big part of my journey. And I didn't have any friends in my network that were into Bitcoin. Just kind of like I did it all on my own, just, you know, stacking some sats and setting up wallets and stuff like that. So Caribou asked me a bunch of, I guess, qualifying questions and realized that, oh, yeah, I actually do understand what Bitcoin is and hold Bitcoin and had been into Bitcoin for several years at that point. And then he said, okay, I want to come meet with you tomorrow. A bunch of us are raising money for you. And I said, great, awesome. I mean, I obviously had no objections to that because I understood Bitcoin. Everyone else, however, was a different story, but that's another issue.
Yeah, we had Caribou on the show back in the spring and we didn't actually get into any of this at all, but it was a real, real pleasure great guy, really great guy. So yeah, I remember because the GoFundMe was like, some astronomical $25 million or something. This is...
No, the GoFundMe was $10.1 million. And that's when it was basically canceled. And I think it might have been canceled because some of the council representing us might not have had our best interests at heart and might have taken an adversarial approach with GoFundMe. This is according to the treasurer. And that's what caused them to cancel it. I wasn't there. That's just what I'm told. So then immediately after, they set up a Give, Send, Go. And the Give, Send, Go got an additional, I think, $13 million. So it was cumulatively about, and it reached, I remember, it reached $9 million, Give, Send, Go, within 12 hours. And right when it got, the next day, the Doug Ford Conservatives in Ontario went to court and sought an injunction against Give, Send, Go to ensure that any Freedom Convoy donations to Give, Send, Go were in violation of that injunction and therefore seized. Give, Send, Go being an American company wasn't, you know, they're basically sitting on the money, and they eventually ended up returning the balance of it. And before that injunction, this is how I remember it. The court documents will kind of lay it all out more clearly. But from what my understanding is, something like $3.5 million did make it through the pipeline and was in the process of being transferred when that injunction was sought. And that's what's being held in escrow right now.
So then I guess, yeah, flashback forward or forward back, you get in touch with Caribou and the idea now is we can use Bitcoin.
Obviously to distribute to the protesters and get money directly to the protesters. And, you know, deal with any sort of ancillary issues. Because we're at the point that there was all money was being seized. So we were in this scenario where we needed to get fuel to the truckers. We needed to get food to some of them. If you don't have fuel for the truckers, those who have external units or the engines, they're just going to freeze. And as you remember, they blocked the fuel trucks. So we had to get the jerry cans to distribute fuel. There were so many logistical issues. And we had so many people with their hands out for money for support. They needed something. Now, there were some people on the ground there who also donated cash and were on the ground and distributing cash to them as well. But, you know, the Bitcoiners came through. And I found out afterwards, this is interesting. I was in a Twitter space maybe a year afterwards, after the convoy. And there was a guy, an Anon Bitcoiner. And he said, he gets on the stage. He's like, you know, I'm pretty frustrated with the Freedom Convoy. I'm like, well, me too. But what did I do? He's like, no, not you. He said the week that they were traveling to Ottawa, he said, I spoke to somebody named Tamara and Chris. I'm like, yeah, Tamara and Chris were two of the people driving across. Tamara's the one who created the GoFundMe. And he said, I told them, you know, we're all Bitcoiners. We're around the world. We're going to raise money for you because they're going to freeze your bank accounts. And I'm like, you guys had more foresight than I did. So I'm like, okay, great. But he said, and I said, well, she never told me this. She never told me she was contacted by Bitcoiners. And I said, what did she say? He said, you're not going to believe this. She said, I don't need video game money. I need real money, and hung up the phone. Oh, now I know why she never told me about that conversation. And when I mentioned to all of them that there's Bitcoiners around the world raising money for us, they responded with, well, that's for criminal activity. Bitcoin's not real money. You know, we're going to get the law all over us if we're using Bitcoin because they're going to think we're money launderers and stuff. And I go, you know, and I've talked many times about how I tried to rapid fire orange pill a bunch of people who can't even turn on a computer, let alone understand what Bitcoin is. And it was just a very frustrating moment.
It's no easy task, even for genuinely Bitcoin curious. It's, it's a complex idea to digest. And it makes me think of an episode we did recently with Tony Yazbek, where Tony was explaining what had happened in Lebanon after the financial collapse of the Lebanese pound. You know, and these are the things, scenarios you're talking about, where I think the same is true for me. You'd never imagine that these kinds of scenarios where the relevance of Bitcoin's uncensorable and unstoppable nature will be the things that we're actually interested in this part of the world, which is, it goes to show how useful that innovation is. The idea of just having a money system where kind of as long as you have the internet, I guess, and even in places they've figured out how to do it without the internet, where you can transfer value without needing the permission of any sort of institution or custodian in between, in the middle of the transaction.
Yeah, I think I've said this a number of times. I'm not the only one. Other people have inferred the same thing. I think the invention of Bitcoin and the innovation of Bitcoin is on par of the printing press. And we're not going to realize, you know, when it's a big invention like that, you don't realize the implications unless it's over a long period of time. It's one of those, we always overestimate change in the short term and underestimate change in the long term. And Bitcoin is a perfect example of the latter. And I think we're going to see the significance or the implication of Bitcoin and of this moment of the freedom, the trucker convoy moment. We're not going to realize the implications of it for at least a couple of generations. At least that's how I see it. Well, look, you'll understand this because, you know, you come from the same background that my brother is, the one that's a CFA. How many times over the years I've asked him, you know, have you heard any chatter about Bitcoin yet in your institution? And he always tells me, like, you know, we're going to be the absolute last ones to get involved because of the conservative nature of pension funds. That's why, you know, what Don Bay does is such important work, because that kind of breaks that wall. But, you know, you can have the most brilliant financial person explain to them Bitcoin, and they may get it, but they don't get it. It hasn't clicked. And I think we all know. Like, me too. It took me, I understood what it was pretty early on, but to be able to psychologically accept that it is what it is and greater, going down that philosophical journey, that takes time. And you can be the most brilliant person in the world, unless you have your neurons firing for an extended period of time to really understand the philosophical implications. Nobody's going to get it right away, or maybe the most brilliant people in the world do, and I'm just an average schmuck. But that's how I see it. Even though I understood what it was, you know, it's kind of like if you've ever driven a Tesla with autopilot, and I hate it. I absolutely hate. I'm a stick shift type of guy, but I love tech. The first time I drove, well, my buddy's got a Tesla in Florida. First time I drove it, put autopilot. Freaked me out. Didn't like it. It's like radar-guided cruise control, which I hate, but on steroids. And it takes it takes you that you, it's this emotional journey that you have to use it over and over and over and over again through repetition. You then start to absorb it and trust it. I think Bitcoin's the same thing.
Yeah, the government's sort of fundamental misunderstandings even of how Bitcoin works and what can and can't be done on the Bitcoin network sort of illustrate some of these points, because during that time, so they, I think, were able to confiscate some wallets that were hosted on exchanges within Canada. This is what I think happened. But there was during the convoy, but there was cold stored wallets that were obviously that couldn't be confiscated.
I know there were a list of wallets that were included in the class action suit. They had some blockchain expert come up with a list of wallets. I know who the hell those wallets were. They were my wallets or anybody I knew, but okay, whatever. But the only Bitcoin they managed to confiscate of the 21, it was approximately 21 Bitcoin that was raised. 17, was it 17? I think was distributed approximately. So, or 16 or 17. Anyways, the remaining Bitcoin, which I think is around five and change, something like that, that is in escrow. And the reason that's in escrow is not because they were able to block any wallets. It's because they send 15 officers to Caribou's house to raid him and take his computer and threaten him and grab the seed phrases that he had. And I had to surrender my seed phrase as well, which was a whole other issue. You know, I had a bunch of these, you know, mouthy, be the nice word, mouthy a-holes online who are the experts of everything that's going on in the world. And would be like, oh, where's the Bitcoin? What's this? The, you know, everybody's a critic. Everybody knows exactly what's going on. During the last week of the protest, when things got really dicey, Caribou had surrendered the seed phrases. We had a court order to surrender the seed phrases. And there's a lesson in this I'll tell you when I'm finished. And I was being told by the OPP that I might be subjected to a warrant. So I better surrender my seed phrase as well, or they're going to come and arrest me. Luckily, obviously, I called a real lawyer, one of the lawyers I produce a podcast for, Not On Record, Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, by the way. I had them call the OPP and tell them, well, this is why Mr. Dichter is not going to be surrendering his seed phrase to you. It's because that would put him in violation of a court order for the class action lawsuit, which would put him in contempt of court. So you had two branches of the government trying to entrap me with this one stupid C phrase. It was making me crazy. And the lesson in all of that, I can't tell Bitcoiners enough. You know, people ask me, what would I have done differently? And there are a bunch of things I would have done differently now that we know what happened. It's easy to be Monday morning quarterback. But get a lawyer. Get a lawyer who understands Bitcoin. Make sure if you think there's going to be any friction with you and the government in any way, make sure you have a lawyer either on retainer or ready for retainer, a lawyer you have a relationship with. That would have saved us a lot of headache. Because imagine it, you're in Caribou's position, 15 officers show up. What do you do? I don't know. I immediately would have called my lawyer. I would have called my brother, who's a police sergeant. I would have called the two of them at once and say, what do I do? There's a warrant. What should I do? But none of us even imagined that the government would continually escalate the situation the way they did. There was no reason to escalate things the way they did. But that's just the brutal incompetence of people in government.
Yeah, and I've heard you talk about this elsewhere, sort of explaining the work that was being done on your end or on the protest side to de-escalate the situation.
Yeah, constantly. And at every turn, the government escalated it every turn. I don't think that would have, like, I made this comment in one of many interviews. I said, you know, if Pierre Trudeau's father were prime minister, and I'm no fan of Pierre Trudeau and his policies, but he definitely had leadership qualities, was not a coward. And I guarantee you, when I was inviting them out, and I said to Jerry Butts and the rest of those fools, come have coffee with us. Just come talk to us. But tell us what's going to be kind of the plan moving forward. That's it. Because we can't have everybody losing their businesses. We're all Canadians. Let's all come together and figure out a way that heals the country. That's it. That was a genuine offer, repeatedly put out, guaranteed. Pierre Trudeau would have walked right out of his office, come right down to us, grabbed a coffee and say, okay, what do you want? And what do you want me to do to get you out of the city? Sort of thing. And you know what would happen? We would have found some common ground, because when you talk to people, even the people you disagree with most vehemently, you can always find some common ground on some issue. But you don't do that when you're a coward and you run away, and that's not leadership. But that's the nature of governance in the world today, which is what leads to these authoritarian-like policies and escalating every matter that doesn't need to be escalated.
So this might be a good time to, you briefly showed your book. It's called Honking for Freedom, and you wrote sort of a detailed summary of your account.
The screen is mirrored.
There you go.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
You can get it at honkingforfreedom.com. And I often, you know, I often read the endorsement from time to time. Was really nice of this person to do it. It says, and this is the pitch for a stocking stuffer for Christmas. So the Canadian trucker protest in Ottawa attracted tremendous national and international attention and was simultaneously demonized by then Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his cronies in the legacy media, the minions at the CBC first and foremost among them. What really happened, Benjamin J. Dichter, integrally involved from the beginning, lets his readers in on the story of one that all Canadians should know, Jordan B. Peterson. And when I told Jordan, when he offered to do the endorsement, I said, do me a favor, do the endorsement as though it's written for somebody who's reading this in the future. Because at some point, we're going to get beyond the Trudeau era. We're going to get beyond, I think, the postmodern era. And I think we are going to head to a more rationalist sort of enlightened period, which is when I want people, this is what the book was written for, because most of it is all the positive stories, not very much politics in it. Like obviously there's mentions of Trudeau and stuff, but this is just how we managed to bring the country together and focused on, at least what I tried to do was focus on our similarities, not our differences, which is also something I try to communicate to our friends in Bitcoin, because it's so easy to have a debate in Bitcoin, but it's a lot more difficult to just let's focus on what we all agree on and the positive attributes of Bitcoin. Because if we do that, I think it becomes easier to bring people into the space.
So what would you say, you know, like you were mentioning earlier ideas about what you would have been done differently, but what did all those events, and now looking back on it, What have you learned about Bitcoin since, or how has this changed your opinion about, if it has, the value of Bitcoin, the importance of helping people understand Bitcoin?
So prior to the Freedom Convoy, Bitcoin was super cool and very interesting. After this period, it's vital. It's absolutely vital as a tool for survival, especially living in an age of uncertainty. You know, 2024, you often hear people say the world is burning, the world's crazy, the world's lost its mind. I don't think it's that. I think it's that 65% of the world's democracies have elections for their national leaders. And that means that the rhetoric is dialed up around the world in 65% of the world's. And so I think we're stemming that right now. But during this sort of period of, I think it's more perceived instability than it is actual instability. But in this world of perceived instability, it is vital to have this insurance policy, because you know what? It makes it a lot easier to sleep at night to know that I have something that can protect me in case things get really bad. You know, I was talking about this the other day for the first time. I've never really talked about this, you know, in the Bitcoin space, but my grandfather came here from Europe. And where he was from, they were, and it was all empires, right? So where was he from? Ukraine, Poland, depending on which day of the week, right? But when he left, the reason he left is everyone there, including himself and his whole family, they were concerned about the communists. They were concerned about the Russians coming down south and invading. So he said he was the younger one. So he decided he was going to leave and get out. Unfortunately, the rest of the family wanted to leave, but they couldn't. You know, they have a little farm, have a business. They couldn't afford to because, you know, everything was in assets. You know, money was not liquid. What are you going to do? Put gold bars and try to smuggle yourself onto a container, not a container, but a shipping vessel to leave the country. So because of the friction of moving your wealth from one place to another, and remember, this is banking internationally, which is still not a joy, was impossible back then. So unfortunately, most of his family was essentially trapped there, and they ended up dying, getting executed in concentration camps. That's how vital this is. Because if this tool was there, then much of the strife that you saw that occurred during World War II might have been avoided if people could take at least a portion of their wealth and digitize it and get themselves out of Dodge. And that goes for other places around the world where there have been genocides ever since, you know, Rwanda as well. There's a whole list of things that have happened around the world since. So it is vital. Now, do I think things are going to get that bad in the West? No, I think our systems are pretty robust. And, you know, we have those periods of highs and lows, but I'm quite optimistic about things over the long term. But having gone through what I've gone through here and some of my family's historical background, I think it's vital for everybody to have some sort of insurance policy for them and their families, because you never know.
And I mean, even if you think about the different types of insurance policies you might be buying with Bitcoin, one of them is insurance on the 100% certainty that money will continue to be worth less in the future. So even if the freedom money use case isn't appealing or doesn't feel necessary as a listener, I think the currency debasement one is certainly something that will impact everyone here. I mean, it already has, but the nature of how currency debasement works is it's a one-way street, and that street gets steeper all the time just as a result of the way compounding works. So,
and you know what's funny? You know, you'll know, like people in the financial industry know that most people are financially illiterate. And that's just the way it is. People are just not interested in finances. Okay, that's fine. And, you know, most people really don't understand, or they didn't really care about inflation. When it's 2%, they just kind of, they think that's normal. But now, isn't it fascinating to see those same people who really don't care about finance or have an interest in it, all of a sudden, even they are starting to use the I word, inflation, and are getting curious. Because, you know, I got a coffee and a bagel this morning. It was exactly double the price it was 3 years ago. Exactly double in just a few years. You can be the most financially illiterate person on the planet, and you feel that. So it's causing people to get curious, and I think that's also been a net benefit for Bitcoin, because unfortunately, the number one most motivating emotional state is fear. That's why politicians use it all the time. And I think inflation's gotten to the point where it's triggered that fear mechanism in people, and they don't see it ending anytime soon. And they're looking for some sort of alternative. And here they come across a whole bunch of people in this thing called Bitcoin who keep using this inflation word. And I think it's spawning some curiosity. That's also why with Bitcoiners, you know, sometimes people get angry at me, and I understand why. I get it. The have fun staying poor thing. I think, and I know that's targeted towards altcoiners. We'll use nice words here, but I think I'm always worried about the average person that really doesn't know anything about Bitcoin but gets just mildly intellectually curious. And I don't want them to run up against the friction that we enjoy between each other, because, you know, we'll banter back and forth and that's cool. But I think when it's people who are just, you know, people are already nervous about learning something new. And I'm trying to do my best to try to mitigate as much as possible the friendly banter, because I think that turns off some people who just might not have the same level of security of discovering something new that the rest of us have, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think that what we've really seen, for me included, 2020 was an event or a time in history where that time created a lot of Bitcoiners, either as the result of, in my case, I was curious about money printing because I was watching all of the different federal programs being designed to enable businesses to stay closed and their employees to be paid to stay home, and just genuinely confused about what this was going to mean for the value of the dollar. And then, subsequently understanding the sort of like other bonus features as that time unfolded. The time since, whatever is being reported as CPI or, price inflation is nowhere near the number as the actual numbers, if you're any person observing the cost of things in daily living. So yeah, in a lot of ways, it feels like, this is an idea that sort of time has come. And the Bitcoin part might be complicated for people to understand, but the other part is not. For people who are what we call ourselves Gen Xers, money did work mostly the same. Although this process has been unfolding for a long time, it was true to say that increasing price of stuff was harder to observe over most of our lives because it was happening at a much slower pace.
When I, prior to watching the documentary I discussed earlier that really taught me about inflation and central banking, it already really bothered me even from the age of being a little kid. I'm a car nut. I'm like stupidly obsessed with cars, always have been. And not just high-end cars, everything. Regular, everyday cars. I just love the engineering, business, whatever. But I always remember I started building models of cars when I was like 4 and 5 years old, those Revell models and stuff like that. And I remember asking my grandfather, how much was a car when you were younger? And I remember him telling me, you could buy a car for $1,000. That was a lot of money. Nobody could afford because you're making, I don't know what it was, a nickel an hour or something like that. So right at an early age, I was so confused. And, your grandparents and parents were always talking about, it used to be a gallon of gas in Canada was 25 cents. Well, why is it, at that point, you're 75 cents a liter. Wow, it's crazy. You know what I mean? So because of my interest in cars and automobiles, I was already seeing what is going on with prices. This doesn't make sense. And I always said, that's just the way it is. I'm like, but why? I always do that. It annoys everybody. My teachers hated it. But why? You know what I mean? So I was already, from a young age, it was already bothering me. Why can't I buy a Corvette for $4,000 like it was in 1967? Why is it $100,000? It doesn't make sense. So I think we all have different experiences in life that get it, front and center of our attention. And for some of us, it comes earlier in life, not necessarily because of finance, but because of other areas of their life that it impacts. And right now, we're just at a state where it's impacting everybody's life, whether it's an area of interest or just a matter of survival. And I think this is our opportunity of Bitcoiners to harness and use, instead of, ridicule and friction, but use empathy to bring people into the state. I have this friend of mine in Colombia. She's never had money. She gets money, she blows it and all that sort of stuff. She's never been good with money. And I spoke to her a few days ago. She got injured. We're just reconnecting. I haven't spoken in like 6 months. And I said, she's curious about Bitcoin. She's going to come. I'm speaking at the Medellin conference in Colombia. So she's going to come there because she's been bugging. I'm trying to learn. I don't understand or whatever. And I said to her in Spanish, I said, you know what? You know why you can't save money? It's not your fault. You got to let yourself off the hook. Don't feel guilty. The system is designed so that you can't store wealth and save your money. It's not you doing something wrong. Yeah, there are some people who have better advantages and whatever, or they have bigger opportunities that came their way they were able to seize, and you just didn't have that. But don't put it on yourself and think you're a failure in life because you struggled to save money, because the system is designed that way, and it's exponentially worse if you live in the third world. So let yourself off the hook. I said, but that's what Bitcoin is trying to solve. And that's why people like myself and others have been trying to get you into Bitcoin, because we know you need help.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a critical technical innovation that solves probably the most pressing problem humanity is facing today, which is...
It's a human innovation.
Yeah, that's great. Great way to say that. So we'll include the links to where people can find your book. You're also a prolific podcaster and writer. And where else can we point listeners to find more of you online or in the real world?
Honkingforfreedom.com for the book. You can also, my Substack's pretty big, so bjdichter.substack.com, or my full name, benjaminjdichter.com, has a bunch of feed links to all my stuff. I've been, active on Twitter for some time. I've been A/B testing Substack notes versus Twitter, and I have some opinions on Twitter. I think it's not a sustainable platform, to be entirely honest. The engagement is significantly higher on Substack notes. And I'm finding on Substack notes, you're also finding people across the political spectrum who are engaging with each other in a more respectful manner. So yeah, Substack, Twitter, anywhere. I'm approachable. I'm available. I do get lots of messages. So if you send me something, it might take me a little time to get back to you, but I try to respond to everybody.
I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing some of your incredible story and involvement in a time which I look forward to seeing how your book is read in when we are much older than we are now.
I think, and I'm hoping, it's going to have a positive emotional impact on generations in the future. And hopefully at that time, we will have found a mechanism to be more unified. One of the podcasts I produced, just an additional side note, I saw this story yesterday, is for a professor by the name of Stephen Hicks. And if you don't know who Stephen Hicks is, Jordan Peterson or Gadsad or Haidt or all these professors that talk about postmodernism, they're referencing Stephen's work. He wrote the book Explaining Postmodernism in the late 90s. That's his thesis. And that's what he's been teaching until recently at Rockford University as a philosophy professor. And Stephen and I are working on something significant for 2025, because we've been playing with this idea together ever since we started collaborating on, I think, and he agrees, we're on the cusp of Enlightenment 2.0, the era of digital enlightenment, and we can make that happen. It's just going to take time. But what's interesting is, a few years ago, I brought up Bitcoin with Stephen. And Stephen likes to research. He's a research professor, so he researches things to death. If he doesn't completely understand it, he doesn't want to talk about it. But he's open to hearing anything. So I pitched him a little bit on Bitcoin here and there. He's like, yeah, I'd like to do an episode on it, but I'm way far beyond. And he seemed not entirely sold, but he understands sound money. He's an Austrian economist, so he's everything you would think a Bitcoiner is. But he was curious. We talk a little bit here and there. And then he calls me up one day and he said, yeah, Bitcoin. He says, yeah, I think I understand Bitcoin. And Bitcoiners, don't get angry. Just focus on the positive here. I said to him, why? What happened? He said, well, do you know somebody by the name of Michael Saylor? And I'm like, well, I don't know personally. He's like, but you know of him? I'm like, yeah, I know of him. He's like, well, we went to dinner last night and he was talking to me about Bitcoin and he was saying a lot of the same things that you've been telling me all this time. So he's like, I think I get it now. And I said, well, why don't I connect you with, I'm going to try to connect you with Robert Breedlove. and you should do an episode of his podcast together, which they did. And took me a while, but now he's on board with Bitcoin. So there you go. It just takes some time, man.
Yeah, one person at a time. And I completely agree with you. I think that, you know, a lot of things might have been more uncertain over the last few years than they were in the 20 years prior to that. But we have more reason for optimism right now than ever. And Bitcoin is a huge part of that. So
also the last thing, and don't lose sight of this. It always feels like we're living in an era where the world is in turmoil. Every generation, you know, my parents growing up during the Cold War, they told me, like, we believed the world could end at any moment. And so we're always, I don't know, brainwashed, but we're primed with this idea that there's all chaos around us. But I got to tell you, man, like, I hear all this division stuff. Well, everything's division. Everything's divisive. Okay. But, you know, when I'm not in front of the computer, I'm in the truck driving across the U.S., talking to everybody from all socioeconomic classes. I try to. And I don't see the disunity. Yeah, you know, the rhetoric is turned up on social media, but that's not real life. Day to day, we just kind of disagree and not everything is political. Like, okay, different worldview. But at the end of the day, I don't think people are inherently cruel. And I think that's something we can build upon in the future. And I think Bitcoin is a big part of that.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, BJ. And if you are listening to the show and you made it all the way to the end, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.